from the sawed-off studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. It is time for another horrifying hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. Have you come across a bunch of strange caterpillar-like pests chowing down on your roses and other plants? I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, we'll discuss the many ways you can address the issue of sawflies. Plus, we'll speak to the orchid grower for the First Ladies. And, of course, take your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and remotely recanted renunciations. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens. It's all coming up like you singing, Sawfly, Don't Bother Me.
WDIY has been broadcasting since 1995.
This is Mayor Ken Smith. Congratulations to WDIY for signing on the air.
We're with Commissioner Frank Donches of the Bethlehem Police Department.
We welcome Dr. John of the Blend today.
Bob Durow composed, conducted, and played much of the schoolhouse rock music.
Three is a magic number.
Step into the antidote to violence is to speak up against it.
WDIY for 30 years.
From the restorative studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another ecological hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks, you bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's In the News, we report on a story that reveals the answer to the question, what happens to a cemetery when it dies? I now quote Stephanie Farr, reporting for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Every once in a while, we encounter a person or place in life that changes our idea of what something is or can be. It doesn't happen often. You're lucky if you get a dozen such moments. But it happened to me as I walked through Steelman Town, 3 miles of moss-covered trails in the New Jersey Pine Barrens that challenged everything I knew about cemeteries. Along those trails, under canopies of green trees, I discovered graves around every corner like they were secret treasures and marveled at moss so dense and lush it felt like carpeting. This is a special place, I scribbled in my notebook. I've never considered being buried before today. Steelman Town Cemetery in Woodbine is New Jersey's first green burial preserve, and I visited there because its owner, Ed Bixby, is the new owner of another graveyard that's closer to home, the once-abandoned Mount Vernon Cemetery in North Philadelphia. That 26-acre burial ground at Lehigh and Ridge Avenues, across from the historic Laurel Hill Cemetery, made headlines when it was listed for sale for $1 million on Zillow. The post went viral, but it didn't mention Mount Vernon's 33,000 dead tenants or the unruly overgrowth laced with poison ivy that volunteers called the Green Inferno. While there was some interest in the property, a viable buyer was not found. And so Bixby, who owns 14 cemeteries from New Jersey to California, was asked if he'd take ownership. He agreed to buy it for a dollar with the condition that all liens against the property would be cleared. Those with direct knowledge of the cemetery said it's worth nothing in its current condition and estimated that it would take several $100,000 to clean up. But Bixby was not deterred, saying, quote, I want to use Mount Vernon as an example of what a cemetery can be. Sometimes in life, tragedy can turn into triumph. Bixby estimates that it will cost somewhere between $350,000 and $400,000 to clean Mount Vernon and restore its gatehouse. He envisions trails through the cemetery turning it into a park and arboretum for the community, and hopes to have the gates open from dawn to dusk within a year. With many records missing, Bixby will use ground-penetrating radar and other methods to identify available space at Mount Vernon for new burials, which will create a revenue stream to make the property self-sufficient. There's going to be plenty of vacant space, he feels. Once Steelmantown became a green cemetery, Bixby received requests from people across the country wanting to be buried there. By 2014, he had buried a dozen Californians in Steelmantown, none of whom had even ever set foot in New Jersey. Today, Bixby owns traditional, natural, and hybrid cemeteries in six states. He was planning on slowing down until, quote, the biggest project of them all, Mount Vernon, fell into his lap. This is the cemetery that can make the largest impact nationally by taking a place that was thrown away beyond hope and turning it into a pillar of the community, he explained, adding, there are Mount Vernons waiting all over the world.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden. From the studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA, I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, sawflies and several easy ways to get rid of them. But first, another one of your fabulous phone calls. 610-694-8100, extension number 3. Adam, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Howdy, Mike. How you doing?
I am just ducky today, Adam. How are you?
Oh, doing fine. It's a little tense around here right now. There's actually an active wildfire somewhat nearby our house.
Oh, man, there's so many of them. Where is your house?
We are just north of Davenport, Washington. It's about an hour west of Spokane.
Oh, okay. And even though most people think of Seattle, Spokane can be really dry, right?
Absolutely, especially this time of year.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, I wish you the best. Okay, what can we do for you today?
Well, something somewhat related to wildfires happened. It's pretty interesting. we're homesteading out here. We kind of live in a canyon. You know, it feels like you're in the mountains a little bit. But we compost our hue manure, and I've been doing that for about 10 years now, and it seems to, you know, worked out well. We've never had any issues with it, but about a week or so ago, we couldn't help but notice 12-foot flames coming out of our compost pile.
Yeah, really? You couldn't help but, huh?
Yeah. Thankfully, we were able to put the fire out pretty quick, but we asked around because there's a bunch of other people around here that compost a similar way, and no one else has, you know, been firsthand to a compost fire before.
Well, you should have called them. Oh, I don't know if you'd want s'mores with humanure in there.
Yeah.
Let me see. Now, do you have composting toilets?
We just kind of use a bucket system. It's not for the faint of heart at first, but over the years you get kind of a cleaning schedule down, and it becomes an enjoyable process, just adding to the cycle of things around the homestead. Yeah.
Because I will mention that going back many years, like at least to the 80s, the classified ads in the back of Organic Gardening magazine always had a couple of ads for true composting toilets. And, you know, this way you had a seat, you had the regular thing. And I believe, although I'm not certain, that you would add worms to it every once in a while to activate the human orb. And before anybody goes screaming from the room, it is perfectly safe and it is a great use for your manure, especially in an environmentally sensitive area. If you've never read it, I recommend a book called Farmers of 40 Centuries. Now, this is one of the books that inspired Sir Albert Howard, who inspired J.I. Rodale to create Organic Gardening and Farming magazine. And it explains how the Chinese agricultural system was based entirely on what they called night soil. There would be privies with special collection areas underneath in the fields. And whenever anybody had to go, they would use these, and then it would be harvested and it would feed the crops. The only reason humanure would be dicey is if you're taking a lot of prescription medicines, especially antidepressants and anti-exotic, or if you have an infection. But those, some of the pharmaceuticals do not break down in the compost pile, and you don't want to get them in the environment. And if you want, I'm sure you can check online to see which ones survive the composting process. I would say the American Composting Council would be a great resource. Or call in to Joe and Teresa Graydon's People's Pharmacy. They would love to deal with a question like that. But anyway, there's centuries of tradition. And of course, right, Matt Damon survived on Mars because he used his poop to grow potatoes. So, you know, we know Hollywood never lies, so that had to work.
Oh, yeah, great movie anyway.
Yeah. Now, what else is in your compost pile?
Well, generally, it's just our human waste, and we mix that with maybe some ash and some wood chips. All of our food scraps end up going to our chickens, so we turn that into eggs, so maybe some onion skins and stuff like that.
But right.
Primarily our waste.
Yeah. Okay. What I would suggest is, well, where you are, you have deciduous trees, right?
Very few, actually. It's mostly pine trees around here.
Okay. Or if you have access to straw, do you use bedding for your chickens?
Yes, we do, yeah. Wood shavings and straw, yeah.
Okay. So what I'm going to suggest is you make most of the pile out of the chicken poop and its bedding and mix your humanure in as you go, because you got a lot of nitrogen happening there. From your stuff and especially the chicken waste, which is one of the highest natural sources of nitrogen. So you need to balance that with carbon-rich materials, which would be straw, anything like that, any leaves you can scrounge. And if you are going to use wood, do you have a chipper shredder or anything like that?
We do not have access to one of those.
Because it would be great. The wood will take forever to break down, and it won't react ideally with the manure. But any small particles of carbon, one of the things I've recommended in the past is corn stalks. Chopped up corn stalks make a great carbon component for the compost pile, especially to balance out all that nitrogen. So think about carbon, dry brown as opposed to wet green. Your humanure qualifies as wet green material, no matter what you've been eating.
All right, okay.
But there's probably lots of woody material around there, cattails, anything that grows green and turns brown. Mix it all well together, and I guess I'm going to feign ignorance here. I guess if you had the right mixture of woody material and your human ore and the chicken material, yes, it could spontaneously combust, especially the bigger the pile. But
oh, yeah.
I seem to remember we got an email from you where you admitted to doing something else.
Yes. Yeah, we had some leftover fryer grease from last Thanksgiving, and we were cleaning out our shop, and we weren't sure what to do with it, so we did dump that on the compost pile, and that was about a week before the fire started.
Yeah, duh.
Yeah.
You know, putting out a fire with gasoline. Yeah, oil
that's something we could have researched first, yeah.
Yeah, oil has no place in a compost pile. It doesn't contribute anything. It could smother, like, lots of good microbes that are turning your waste into good compost and interrupt the process. Do you have access to any restaurants nearby?
Yeah, there's a few near the town here, yeah.
Because they can probably take your waste oil and combine it with their own, and then that's sold to make biofuel.
Oh, that's good to know.
Oh, yeah. Used cooking oil is a big deal these days in recycling and reusing. It's very valuable. Or you could imitate the great E.B. White and take that oil and coat the surfaces inside your chicken coop with it to prevent mites.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah, he wrote about that. He, E.B. White, the famous editor of The New Yorker, during the war, he volunteered to be an egg supplier, and he was sending hundreds and hundreds of eggs, maybe a day, maybe a week, to the military. And he didn't throw anything away either. I think maybe this was even when he changed the oil in his car. He put the oil on the roosts, and that helped keep the mites down because they got stuck in it. Oh. But I would think cooking oil would do the same. But don't put it in the compost pile because this will happen again.
Okay, deal. Yeah, won't be doing that again.
All right, well, congratulations on being pioneers. You got more courage than I do. I like my running water. But
I know nothing beats a good flusher, but you know, this is an enjoyable process still.
Yeah, good. So. Well, you know, I think, I know it would be an investment, but if you buy one of these composting toilets, I think it imitates a flush.
Okay.
And then with a collection chamber underneath, just like the Martian, where it's all nice and collected for you, and you won't starve to death when you're on Mars.
That's awesome. Well, I don't know. You probably have to pack pretty light to go to Mars, but if we can bring some with us, we will.
Yeah. Well, you can always make some on the way.
All right. So, yeah.
Well, it's great to talk to you, and I understand your partner, Emma, is there too. And I wanted to shout out to her. Hello, Emma.
Yeah, hey there, Mike.
So, Adam and Emma, wish them luck.
Well, yeah, thanks again, Mike. Great to talk to you.
Oh, my pleasure. You too, take care.
All right, bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody out there that this season's garlic crop is being harvested and cured as we speak. And that means the time is now to order some premium heads of garlic that you will plant this September to enjoy a stinking good harvest next July. But don't go perusing those garlic growing sites just yet, because we'll be right back to discuss the wonderful world of orchids and take more of your wonderful phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
For the past 3 decades, WDIY has sustained itself through direct contributions from listeners. Our model is simple. The people who listen to the service are the ones who support the service. As WDIY celebrates its landmark 30th anniversary, we invite you to join us as a WDIY member by making a membership gift today. This is something you could do right now to make a meaningful difference in your community. Call 610-694-8100 extension 4 or online at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, sawflies, one of the most unusual, creepy, and weird and misidentified insect pests you will ever hear about it. We're going to tell you about them and what you can do about them. But right now, it is time to welcome our very special guest, Arthur Chadwick, who is in charge of Chadwick and Son Orchids Illustrated, with many locations near and around the Richmond area. And we got quite a few stories about you, Art, so let's dive right into it. How are you?
Okay. Great. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being had. Now, the reason you're on the show is a press release I got announcing that your company had won a nice award at the Chelsea Flower Show in London, or in England, the largest outdoor flower show in the world. And as a result of that, you've been invited to display at the largest indoor show in the world, the famed Philadelphia Flower Show, which always occurs right around the first week in March. So tell us about the exhibit that got you the award and how you intend to repurpose it or just show it the way it was.
Right. Well, first of all, it's a little crazy to put an orchid exhibit on in another continent, but that's what we decided to do. We were sort of regulars in England visiting the Chelsea Flower Show, as everyone does.
Uh-huh.
And last year, we got to know enough people where they said, here, I want you to meet the show chairman. The show chairman, okay, let's meet the show chairman. So she said, would you like to have tea with me? Well, next thing you know, she asked us to be in the show, which is really not feasible for someone, you know, so far away. But she said, just think about it. And so we thought about it, and a couple months later, we said, you know, we could probably do this. We can't bring our own orchids into the country, so we would have to borrow orchids once we got there. But we could certainly design the exhibit here and get a construction team in there and get the filler plants in there. And that's what we did. And I had seven people there living in London for 2 weeks, working practically around the clock, it seemed like, putting together this orchid exhibit. We were complete newbies. Really, we were just trying to, you know, make it reasonable. We didn't even know there were awards to begin with. And the judges came by with their fancy clipboards, and gosh, you got a silver gilt medal. That's just below a gold. And the reason we didn't give you a gold is because you didn't have enough orchids. Well, I can't take that personally because I couldn't even bring my orchids with me. So essentially, we did the best we could possibly do, and the audience really loved it. We were the only American exhibitor out of 87 in the great pavilion, and it was well received.
Well, I know exactly how much trouble you had to go to. I've never had to travel internationally, but when I was the editor of Organic Gardening, we presented five major displays over the course of 5 years. And these are the big ones, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we took best of show in our category 4 years in a row.
Wow. Well, then I'm in good company.
Yeah, exactly. A couple of winners for a change. Now, I presume you're going to have more orchids when you present at Philly this spring.
Yes, we'll be able to bring our own orchids, which should make quite a difference. We only had 12 in the one in London. So we could easily bring 10 times that many. The real knockout punch at the Chelsea show was it's closed to the royals for 1 hour on opening day, and everyone has to leave except one person from every exhibit. And I was the one person standing in front of our exhibit. And you don't know what royals are coming or what doors they're coming in or where they'll go. So we all waited there patiently. We dressed up as nicely as we could. And Charles came in, and he was looking at the gladiolus. He didn't even come close to the orchids. But Camilla came right in the door and beelined right to our space. And I showed her the flower that we named after her. And she was absolutely thrilled. I couldn't have the real thing, of course, because I couldn't bring my own orchids, but we had a big poster of it. And fortunately, a photographer got the picture of her in our exhibit, shaking hands with me and, you know, oohing and aahing about this hybrid. So now we really have something. Knowing we have a royal endorsement, essentially.
Yeah, you have a history of naming orchids, I was going to say after famous people, but it's heads of state or the spouses of heads of state. So was Camellia your first outside the United States named orchid?
Well, we had done Margaret Thatcher back in the 90s. But as far as royals, absolutely. And we have a whole line of royal hybrids, but they just stay here in our greenhouses in Virginia because we can't really ship anything overseas.
Right.
So we just get to enjoy them. But Camellia, she was all over this one.
That's great. And you and your late father have supplied orchids or named orchids after how many first ladies now?
Well, let's see. The tradition of naming first ladies goes back to Mrs. Woodrow Wilson. But we did the past six. We're not quite as old as Mrs. Woodrow Wilson. But we've done the past six administrations from Barbara Bush through today. And this is a tradition that's been going on for quite some time with other growers around the country. And it sort of died away in the 80s once the corsages weren't being worn as much as they used to be, or even at all. And so I was reading about it in the old Orchids magazine. I said, Dad, we really should pick up this legacy. It's just sitting there. So we started with Barbara Bush, and here we are six administrations in. And now every time there's a new administration, they call us right away and say, okay, how's this orchid thing work?
Okay, that's fabulous. Now, I have to say one thing that had me laughing out loud reading your book was your experience with Hillary Clinton. She shut you down twice, right?
Well, I mean, the security surrounding the first ladies is unreal. And you're lucky if you get just a few seconds with any one of them. We actually had 2 whole minutes with Mrs. Clinton. And, you know, I had a tuxedo on. It was fancy. And the bomb-sniffing dogs everywhere. And she just wanted to talk about babies. And my wife was pregnant, and she wanted to talk about babies. But we tried to keep the conversation focused on the orchids. And we had 2 minutes with her, and she was very appreciative.
Now, which first lady do you think showed the most appreciation when she saw her orchid?
Well, I would have to say Laura Bush, who is actually an avid gardener. She's active in the Dallas Garden Club. And so she knew all about the orchids. And when I speak down there, there she is in the front row.
Ha!
And it's a little intimidating to be talking about first ladies, and there is a first lady.
Well, yeah, or people could say you brought along the ultimate prop for your show.
Yes, yes.
Now, how do you choose which orchid will be named after which person? Do you try to figure out a personality type, whether they're flamboyant or reserved, although with corsage orchids, I don't think there is any reserved, right?
Well, that's a great question. Certainly, you don't get a dialogue going with the first lady before this process begins, because it takes 7 years to bloom one of these Cattleya orchids from seed. So we have this long pipeline of plants that are in production, and as they bloom, we set them aside if they're really spectacular for someone special. I mean, everybody's special, but as far as for the first ladies or White House or some kind of dignitary. So when a new first lady comes in, we look at the plants we've set aside and say, let's see, we've got a beautiful yellow hybrid. Mrs. Biden is a blonde. How about that? So that's how Mrs. Biden's orchid came to be.
Yeah, I saw that. There's a picture of that in your book, right?
Yep,
and
uh-huh.
I should mention the name of the book. First Ladies and Their Orchids, A Century of Namesake. Now, come on, help me here. Cattleyas?
Cattleya.
Cattleya.
Like kitty cat. Cattleyas, yep.
By A.A. Chadwick and Arthur Chadwick. And Double A was your dad, right?
That's right, yes.
How recent is this book?
It just came out last summer.
Oh, okay. Good, good. And in addition to, like, stunning orchid photos. Now, I will add here, how can you not take a stunning orchid photo? but it is one of the plants that people love to just look at. Now, as I'm paging through the book, I was wrong. It isn't just First Ladies that you've got. You named an orchid after Priscilla Presley, Farrah Fawcett, Elena Stewart. What brought these about?
Well, each one has its own story, but they all are attached to orchids in some way. And so they're excited to be, maybe we have a common friend between us, like Priscilla and I have a common friend. Everybody seems to have a common friend with somebody famous. And so you just go through the common friend, and I'm an orchid grower. Would you like an orchid named after you? Yes, no, nothing. But Priscilla was like, absolutely. When I was 16, Elvis gave me 16 purple cattleyas for my birthday. And ever since then, I've been in love with cattleyas, specifically purple. So if you could make a purple one for me, I would be very appreciative. So we started this dialogue, and I was just sending her plants out in Beverly Hills, and she would send me pictures, blah, blah, blah. And twice now I've had a chance to, once I had lunch with her, once I had dinner with her, just the two of us. It's amazing how orchids bring people together of all walks of life.
Oh, absolutely. They're the plant you can't not look at.
Right.
Now, I notice back here in the back, you actually have a nice page showing the orchids of the First Ladies. Now, the top rows are orchids you did not present, but you know the names and pictures of?
Yeah, we don't go back to Mrs. Woodrow Wilson. We're strictly, the modern-day First Lady, six administrations. But before that, other growers did them. So I wrote a chapter about each of their hybrids and the grower that made it happen. So it's one continuous 19 consecutive First Ladies project. And we donate one of each to the Smithsonian, as well as Longwood Gardens and other botanical gardens around the country.
And I was pleased because of my background. Lady Bird Johnson has been a huge advocate for the environment, especially birds and native plants. So I'm glad to see she got an orchid.
Absolutely. She's known for her wildflowers along the highways in all 50 states. And yet she did not have an orchid named after her. Her husband had several, but she did not have any. So we jumped in and said, hey, we need to fix this. And so we retroactively named one after her and presented it to her daughter.
And is there any idea, plan, whatever you want to call it, to go back to the beginning and name an orchid for each First Lady, including like Martha Washington and stuff?
Well, we sort of started, the tradition sort of starts where it became in vogue in the United States, which was right before World War I. Before that, orchids were completely unknown to everyone here. They're from South America or Asia. They didn't even know they existed. So that's really where it starts, because we want something that's authentic that the people could have actually known at the time.
Right. I'm surprised, however, that Washington and Jefferson didn't bribe a ship's captain into, because they were notorious for that.
That could have happened. That could have happened. We just don't have proof that that happened.
Constantly out trying to outdo themselves. So we're going to look forward to your exhibit at the Philadelphia Flower Show. But before I let you go, I want to talk a little bit about your fascinating business. Now, you're in the greater Richmond area, and you've got how many greenhouses?
Well, let's see. I think it's 13 at the moment.
And then you have, for lack of a better word, two retail stores?
Yep, right there in the city. They're like florist shops, but they just carry orchids.
Right. But you provide services that I've never heard of. And I got a kick out of your orchid boarding program where, like, you send kids to summer camp to get them out of the house for a couple of months. People send you their spent orchids and you bring them into bloom again.
That's a great analogy. It's like sending the orchids off to camp. Except in this case, people don't want to see them again until they come back into bloom, which is usually a year later. So we have the orchids for about a year. We're bringing them back, and their living room table is empty, waiting patiently for that orchid. And then we call them, your orchid's ready. Oh, my gosh, is it the purple one? Is it the yellow one? Gosh, I'll leave my key under the mat and, you know, what have. So we have little heated trucks that go through the neighborhoods of Richmond bringing people their rebloomed orchids. And people sit there out of bloom orchids on the front step for us to pick up, just like the milkman.
I was going to say, like the milkman. Do you stick a note in one if you want some cream, too?
Yes, it's very popular. We've never really advertised that we offer this service. It's always been word of mouth. Hey, did you hear that Chadwick will take your orchids and bring them back? What? Take them all. So now we have 13,000 plants we're babysitting for people in the Richmond area.
That's a business unto itself.
Yep, that's what actually drives our nursery is the orchid boarding.
And you have one-day service. Somebody can call you up and say they want a special orchid for a special person, and within a day, you will have it delivered to their house.
That's true. Yep. I mean, we know everybody. We've been doing this for decades now, and we're on to the second, even third generation of families. So people just know if they want orchids, just call Chadwick's, and we're right there.
That is amazing. How often do people get next day deliver? I mean, you're the Amazon of plants.
Well, if it's a new plant, you know, it comes, you know, maybe a dozen a day. But if it's orchid boarding, it's about 100 a day because we have that many people's plants that are coming back into bloom all the time that need to go back to their owners.
And what a great way for them to recycle plants in season, put up something different and then bring back the old faithful. How many years would a well-kept orchid live and continue blooming? I'm thinking it's in the decades.
Oh, it's easily decades. My father had many plants over 100 years old. And from there, they came from the jungles. So there's no reason why an orchid wouldn't live forever if taken care of. And we often see these in wills where people are leaving their orchid collections to different people because they're going to outlive the people.
That's amazing. And all of your greenhouses, well, your two retail stores are retail, and I presume they're open. Oh, here it is, Monday, Saturday, 10 yep. a.m. to 6 and 9 a.m. to 5.
Yep.
Oh, and even the greenhouses, the tours are 9 to 5, so people don't even have to make reservations?
Oh, no reservations. And actually, the true gardening people come out to the greenhouses because you can walk in all the 13 greenhouses and see how these things are grown on a large scale. We can repot them. We can get messy and muddy and walk over hoses and whatnot and really just be like the orchid grower.
Yeah, you've got a versatile, really impressive business model here. You really got me with the orchid boarding that, you know, that's the first time I've encountered this in my many years in the business. How should people find you?
Well, certainly, we'd love to have you visit personally. A lot of people drive down 95 to go anywhere,
right.
And it goes right to Richmond. So we'd love to have you in person. You can always order through our website, or we even sell rare orchids on eBay. But we'd love to see you in person if possible.
But the website is ChadwickOrchids.com.
That's right.
And the new book is First Ladies and Their Orchids, A Century of Namesake Cattleyas.
Yeah, you got it.
Did I get it?
The classic corsage orchid that Grandma used to wear.
Oh, well, you know, the history of the corsage orchid, we could go on forever. but it's by the father and son team of Chadwick, AA, and Arthur E. And I look forward to seeing you at the Philadelphia Flower Show in our bicentennial year. This is a big deal over here.
That's right. So we'll probably make one change to our Chelsea exhibit for Philadelphia. Maybe we'll take out the royal orchids and put in the first lady orchids so that they're relevant to the Americans.
I think that would be an excellent idea. And looking at the first lady orchids, you got tons there. Art, it's been a real pleasure having you on today.
Thank you, Mike. You're a legend.
Yeah, in my own lunchtime. All right. Well, do good work, and I hope to see you in Philly.
That would be lovely. Can't wait.
Bye-bye for now, then. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and alert folks who will be first-time garlic growers this season that planting certified disease-free heads from a reliable source are your best bet for garlic success. Second best would be bulbs that you buy from a local farmer at a producer-only farmer's market, meaning them what's selling it actually grew it. But don't settle for supermarket garlic. Spend a few bucks and buy the real thing. But don't go looking up your options just yet, because we'll be right back with everything you need to know about sawflies and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. What can you expect to hear next week? Hilarity, bad jokes, a small amount of useful information, and me. As long as these bolt cutters keep working. Boy, you know, this station must buy locks by the dozen. I'm Mike McGrath, and that's probably on the next You Bet Your Garden. Maybe. Plus your fabulous phone calls. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden. From the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, I am your host, Mike McGrath, and we are in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will talk about one of the creepiest, crawliest garden pests you may ever encounter, and several easy ways to get rid of them. But first, another one of your fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100, extension number 3. Bill, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. This is Bill from Yardley, PA again. I got a question on one of your favorite topics, garlic. One of the things is, you know, where am I going to be planting this stuff next year? I actually planted mine right down the middle of my raised beds because, you know, they wind up being planted, you know, in another month or so, and they just sit there, and everything can grow up around it. And since they're all the way in the middle, I don't have to, you know, reach as far to get to the other plants that I planted. But I didn't have that much space once I run them down the middle, and I heard that, you know, I should be maybe rotating these like I do with potatoes and for tomatoes.
Well, now when you say, first of all, I think it's a great tactic to plant your garlic down the center of a raised bed, because as you know, you don't have to do anything to garlic until it escapes in the early summer. And so there's no reason to reach in there, and you're using the space. How wide are your raised beds?
They're 4 feet wide for the most part, usually about 4x8.
And how many beds do you have?
Well, I just put in 2 more, and I have 4 at this point, and then I have a bunch along the fence, which are only 2 feet wide.
Okay. And this past season, your harvest now, was there garlic planted down the center of all your beds?
No. The new ones didn't have anything because I'm just putting them in now, so I could possibly move them over there. I don't put them through all of the beds, but there's a couple beds that have things like strawberries and asparagus, and I don't put them in there.
No, you can't mix asparagus and garlic. It would just have underground prize fights.
Yep.
Well, if you have raised beds that you haven't done this with before, there's certainly no reason not to pick out your biggest cloves from this year's harvest and plant them in that fresh soil. And then all you got to do is get some plant markers and mark the lanes where garlic grew this year. And let that rest, or, you know, put something else in there that you don't have to worry about, flowers or something like that. And that'll give you a year. And as long as you're not experiencing symptoms, I think you can go back and forth for a couple of years. It'll let you know. It'll let you know if you're doing things wrong. Now, what do you plant in the skinny bed?
Usually those are beans. We have the scarlet runner beans because it's a chain link fence.
I love
that. And, of
course,
they just like to go up there. And I intersperse them with some tomato plants, so just for some variety.
Okay, so you got no room there.
No, not really, because they're not that deep, and I do use a lot of the other space for other things.
So how many bulbs or how many cloves do you hope to plant in September?
Usually about 2 to 3 dozen.
Well, I think you can probably get by with rotating them back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I essentially have 2 8-foot sections where I could probably put these things in. So going back and forth in that case would be easy.
Just remember, because you will be eventually using soil that grew garlic before, that when you're getting ready to plant, you soak the cloves in baking soda solution for a couple of hours. And then when you take them out, soak them in cheap vodka for another couple of hours before planting. And that will help keep disease at bay two different ways.
That sounds like a great idea. I'll have to make sure I do that this time around.
Yeah, I think I made it up, but I'm not sure. But it works for me.
Excellent.
All right, what else you got?
That's pretty much it. I did come up with some interesting trellises, if anybody's interested. I know that you had done one that had, you know, the metal fencing for your tomatoes, but I could never get my hands through those things very easily. So I picked up some, and I'm trying to remember what the name is, but they're essentially plastic pieces, and you can put them in essentially 3 stands, and they snap together, and then you snap them and build them up. And you can build them into squares as well. So,
what I do, you know, when I'm using, for those who don't know, welded wire fencing, not chicken wire, lay out a 6-foot length, cut it to length, and then cut in and out at each section so you get twist ties to hold it all together, and then stake the cage, not the tomatoes. And then when there's a real big tomato I want, I cheat. Because remember, kids, cheaters always win. I'd take a good pair of cutters, wire cutters, and I'll just open a door.
Ah, okay.
I'll literally, you know, just take one section out, not breaking it off, and then when I get the tomato out, I'll just close it back up again.
Okay. That sounds good.
All right. So that's the story. I like your idea.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much for the tips, and we'll let you know how the garlic goes next year.
Okay. Please do, and we'll talk to you again.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. All right, as promised, it is time for the question of the week. Sawflies, a truly weird garden pest. Nancy in Forks Township, PA, recently called into the show and left a message on our answering machine, 610-694-8100, extension number 3, about sawflies on her hibiscus plants. But she wasn't available to talk about it on the show. Sawflies, possibly the strangest insect pest out there, are a topic that doesn't come up often, and we have not discussed them in a while. And now we shall. Although they look exactly like creepy, crawly caterpillars, sawfly larvae do not become moths or butterflies. Nor do they turn into any kind of flies, as their name suggests. I now quote from the Missouri Botanic Gardens' excellent website. Sawflies are in the same order as ants, wasps, and bees. Their name derives from the adult female's abdominal appendage, which she uses to insert eggs in plant foliage. Adult sawflies have two pair of wings and are dark, wasp-like, somewhat flattened insects, usually a half an inch long or shorter. Most of the surface-feeding larvae, those are the caterpillar lookalikes, have six or more pairs of prolegs on the abdomen and one large, quote, eye on each side of the head. An exception is the pear sawfly, whose larvae resemble a small, dark olive-green slug. It is difficult to adequately describe the caterpillar-like larvae, many of which are yellow with black dots, look like refugees from a horror movie, and tend to appear in large clusters, which makes them even creepier. But despite their uncanny resemblance, they are, once again, not caterpillars of any kind, and so the trusted organic caterpillar killer, Bacillus thuringiensis, better known as BT, has no effect on them. And no shame on those who have tried. It's the first thing I would have done. And there isn't just one type of sawfly. Quote, the bristly rose slug is, as the name implies, a slug-like sawfly larva, one of several types that feed on roses. It is shiny black to pale green. By maturity, it develops many bristle-like hairs on its body, from which its name, duh, bristly, is derived. Young larvae skeletonize the lower leaf surfaces of their favorite host, while mature larvae chew large holes in the leaves. The good news is that sawflies generally don't do much damage, and ignoring them is one option. Ignoring things going wrong in the garden is often my favorite option. Furthermore, the Botanic Garden site continues, a number of natural enemies keep most sawfly populations low, including parasitic wasps, birds, small mammals, and predaceous beetles, as well as fungal and viral diseases. Organic gardeners should always remember that what looks like a pest to you is a big, delicious bag of protein to a predator, especially in this case, birds. Little side note, when a single nest of tent caterpillars appeared in my crabapple tree this spring, I told my assistant, the awesome Ninja Sean, to just poke at it with the longest-handled hoe we had and make a tear in it. And then what, he asked. That's it. We're done. The birds will take it from here. And the next day, there wasn't a single caterpillar left. Birds are a gardener's best friend. To get them to work for you, do not feed them bird seed. They'll fill up on the seed and leave your pests alone. Bird feeders are not good for birds for many reasons, including and especially the spreading of disease due to the unnatural crowding that feeders cause. Bird feeders are 100% for your amusement only. The birds do not need them. They've been feeding on pests like sawflies since sawflies were there for them to eat, and they will continue to do so unless you fill them up with junk food. If you want to really lean into attracting flying friends to your garden, have bird baths around your plants. Birds don't need human-supplied food in the summer, but fresh water can be scarce at times. Give them lots of fresh water, and they'll return the favor by eating your pest insects. Again, the Missouri Botanic Garden notes that a few sawfly larvae on a large or mature plant may do little damage and can be tolerated. And when larvae become half-grown or larger, they eat even less. Leaving the larvae alone for birds to manage naturally could be a good and beneficial solution. Oh, and sawflies that are feeding in the mid to late summer also do less harm to plants. Other simple solutions include hand-picking the little monsters. They don't sting like some venomous caterpillars. And the classic, spraying them off your plants with sharp streams of water, which I have come to realize is the single most misquoted and misunderstood of all my organic suggestions. We are talking about sharp streams of water, S-H-A-R-P, not gentle sprays. You need to use an adjustable nozzle that has a laser-sharp setting. If you don't see the pest go flying off the plant when you spray it, it is not sharp enough. If you have lousy water pressure, you can buy an inexpensive nozzle that funnels even a weak flow through a smaller diameter tube to create a powerful force. You can also just prune off any affected plant parts, trash them, and go home early. And finally, if spray something, you must. Yes, I know who you are. You can smother them with professionally made insecticidal soap or a horticultural oil designed for use in the summer. Not dormant oil. That's only for use on fruit trees over the winter. Sure was some hopefully helpful information about sawfly control. Now, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read the details over at your leisure, or of course, your leisure, by following the link for the Gardens Alive question of the week at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Yikes, my producer is threatening to supply me with sawflies if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100 and follow the prompts to reach You Bet Your Garden. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. I'm begging you. Like I said, I'd get down on my knees, but then I'd need help getting back up again. Tell us your location when you write or call us. Please. And visit our Facebook page, where we are always posting new photos of the stuff that looks good right now in my garden, important and informative updates about the show, a link to the written version of the Gardens Alive question of the week, and links to our priceless podcast. It's all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when Philadelphia was reduced to a small size and kept in a 5-gallon spring water jug in Brainiac's spaceship. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Northfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziprote. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the awesome Ninja Sean. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'll continue to harvest and cure what looks to be an excellent crop of garlic and help myself to the last of the delicious wine berries before the birds get them. And then I'll see you here next week.